You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 370 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batman the Brave and the Bold number 9, the Tom King story only, the Penguin number 6, Amazon's Attack number 4, Detective Comics 1081, the Flash number 5, Titans Beast World number 5, and Bodies season 1 episode 1, You're Dead Already. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright Cletus, first up for DC news. DC's Titans is getting a new series regular artist in the form of Lucas Meyer, who will be joining writer Tom Taylor on the book starting with issue number 9. I didn't recognize the name, but I'm kind of sad to see Nicola Scott leaving.
Yeah, I agree. I've definitely enjoyed the artwork on Titans. And the name doesn't ring a bell, but I don't know for sure if I... we'll see when that issue comes out. I guess I'll know if I've seen that artwork before or not, but it doesn't ring a bell off the top of my head. It doesn't seem like Nicola Scott sticks on series for a super long time for whatever reason, so if they're going to swap her off, I'm glad that they're just officially doing it and not, like, you know, rotating artists, and then after a couple issues, she's just not an artist anymore. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. If you're going to do it. Just commit. Yeah, we'll see. Obviously, we're both big fans. I don't know. I don't know enough about the new guy to have a positive or negative opinion.
Yeah. So we just have to wait till we review the episode or review the issue to find out what we think about it. All right. And moving on to our last bit of DC news, Superman Legacy gets title change from James Gunn. Drop the Legacy. James Gunn reveals that the new Superman movie will simply be called Superman, writing in a post celebrating the first day of filming. When I finished the first draft of the script, I called the film Superman Legacy. By the time I locked the final draft, it was clear the title was Superman. Making our way to you, July 2025. Along with the post, James Gunn shared an image of the Superman logo from the film. The snow dusting on the logo suggests a scene set in the Fortress of Solitude.
I'm excited, Drew. I'm really excited for this starting to film. There was a table read, cast photo that they put out. So we got a sneak peek of Nicholas Holt with his shaved head. And I got to say, Drew, he looks a lot more natural with it than Jesse Eisenberg did. And that's not to criticize Eisenberg in that regard. And, Holt just, lack of better term, wore it better or didn't wear it better. I don't know if it's just because Eisenberg is so, like, specific in his look and is distinct in the roles that he takes. I don't know what it was, but that made me excited. I've seen some people comment that changing the Superman name to just Superman, muddles it with the original Superman that came out, and it'd be nicer to have some sort of differentiating title. And I get that, but, I mean, how many Batman movies? You know what I mean? So I get it. I just hope it's good, man. I'm really excited. I really want it to be good. I'm very optimistic that it will be. It's not surprising that it's starting to film, but the film always feels a little more real when they actually, film the thing. So I'm pretty excited, and hopefully, maybe sometime San Diego Comic-Con potentially we'll get, I don't expect a trailer, don't get me wrong, but maybe an image by then of Superman and maybe some of the other characters in costume. That'd be really cool to put out then.
It would be. I'd be excited about seeing some stuff. So it's exciting. It's starting to film, so it feels more real now. All right. Well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
What's new on the 42 cast? Let's ask my co-hosts.
We're talking about Doctor Who,
comic book shows and movies,
and we're talking about all things Star Trek
and so much more.
Check us out on Google Play, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
It's only on the 42 cast, your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything.
So Nathan, when are we finally talking Babylon 5?
We are the Cigar Nerds, bringing nerdy sophistication and geeky indulgence on all topics, including movies, video games, science, and pop culture news, all from the Nerd Cave Cigar Lounge. Find us on iTunes, Stitchers, Google Play, and wherever fine podcasts are found, including ESONetwork.com and CigarNerdPodcast.com. So fire up a cigar. It's time to get nerdy.
And we're back, but before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk Batman, the Brave and the Bold, number 9. All right, and we're only reviewing the Tom King story. Gotham City, year 1. Alfred calls Batman, worried that he has gone after the Joker when he is still injured. Batman tells Alfred he is fine. Alfred can put some tea on because this won't take long. Adams Park, North Gotham. The police car Batman has been chasing just crashed into a tree. Batman checks the squad car. The Joker has already vacated it. Batman is searching through the woods when the Joker attacks him with a knife. Batman gets some punches in, but the Joker ends up stabbing Batman in the abdomen. Batman falls to the ground and passes out. Later, Batman wakes up and pulls the knife out. Joker is still there. Batman tells Joker a joke and then starts laughing hysterically. Batman takes down the Joker. Spring Lake. Bruce Wayne and Alfred go fishing. Bruce explains that the Joker just watched him for hours after he passed out. When Batman woke, he was still there, so Batman put him down. Alfred states that maybe they both wanted something from each other. When Batman peered into Joker's eyes, did he not see something familiar? Wayne Manor. Bruce runs into Brute, who states if Batman hadn't interfered, Joker would be a stain right now. Brute gives Bruce some advice to stay away from the monsters of Gotham because Bruce will never be an alpha dog. Arkham Asylum. Batman pays a visit to Joker and asks him why he didn't kill him. The Joker states he could ask Batman the same question. The Joker says, "Oh Batman, my Batman, brave and bold, we're going to have such a grand time together, aren't we?" I don't know if it had been just because it had been such a long time since we read this story, but it took me a little bit to get into this story, Cletus, and I don't know, I didn't feel about it quite like I did the other parts of the story.
That's interesting. I mean, it is different in a sense because you finally have the full confrontation between Batman and Joker. It's been a lot of build up to this issue. I found it really interesting, Drew, that the first time we get Joker, I'm pretty sure, unless I'm misremembering, the first time we actually see Joker speak on a panel is after Bruce makes a joke and starts laughing, like kind of loses it and laughing, and Joker says, "You're insane." That was, I kind of liked that, Drew, that was the first time we don't get the like silent film captions for the Joker is when he, I think in that moment is when he fully recognizes in his mind a kindred spirit in Batman, or like the opposite of him in Batman. That I found really interesting. I will agree, you know, it's tough, Drew, because Joker was so like almost like a supernatural evil almost in the first few issues of this, where he was just obviously terrible, but a lot of it was sort of unspoken horror, right? And with this, you like at the I don't know how you end the story without Bruce and the Joker coming into direct conflict with each other, but I do think that's why it feels different, because everything with the Joker up until this point has left a lot to your imagination, right? Like the Joker's been very present, but it's mostly like seeing what he's doing either right before or right after he's done something awful, and it's a lot of just sort of like insinuated terror. And then we got a little bit of it in the last issue. And then with this one, instead of being sort of unseen, he's right there, right? The camera's right on him, so to speak. And I do think it loses a little of that mystique that the first few issues built up. But I don't know. I'm not sure how else you conclude. Like, because I don't know how you finish the story without them coming to blows.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I don't know. It just felt different to me. And
yeah.
And I wasn't sure if it just because we hadn't read the story for a while and it didn't. And
yeah,
it took
I
me a bit to get
helped.
Back into it or something, or what?
Because I was a little bit shaky on what had happened exactly last also. Like, the cop car, I did not initially realize Joker was in that until I should have already realized that the Joker was there. You know what I mean? So it definitely took me a little bit to get back into it, too. I mean, yeah, Drew, I don't really disagree with you. It definitely felt a little different. I do think it would benefit if we had read it all together. I don't know. I definitely think some of the stuff, especially like Bruce talking to his not really friend, I think that would have resonated more if that hadn't been like 5 months ago that we read that guy's part of the story. So I do think time passage hurt a bit. And then I have to, like, again, this is sort of the problem though, Joe, sort of the inherent problem with Joker stories though, Drew, is that, I mean, it really feels like Bruce ought to kill the Joker, right? And again, this is always sort of even when it's Tom King writing it, and even Tom King even sort of seems to be making that point, like, there's really, like, Bruce really ought to have put Joker down. And I know that that's his line, but even Tom King is sort of questioning it, like, I mean, yeah, it's sure that's you're telling yourself that that's what makes you different, but, like, think about the countless horrors that this guy had already committed, and this is just the first time that they've interacted with each other.
Right. And if you think about it, honestly, Joker actually won this. He chose not to kill Batman.
Yeah.
So, that's a little different, too, because normally we don't see...
Yeah, I found that interesting, Drew, in that what I liked that Tom King did there is that he left it enough of a question mark that it wasn't entirely clear whether Joker could have finished the job or not. Because Bruce at least theorizes that the Joker was completely spent at that point, had basically nothing left himself, which is why he was effectively down for the count and just watching Bruce, which is believable. But then you get Alfred pointing out, like, do you really think that's what he was doing? Or do you think that he basically saw the same thing that you see in him? I thought that was a good little bit of writing, Drew, because it calls it into question enough that it's not just on its face completely unbelievable that Joker would just sit there, right? There's at least enough plausible deniability that, like, oh, I could maybe see it. It's still a leap of faith for the reader, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to completely absolve King of that, but I think he put enough in there to make the reader kind of question why Joker might have still been there.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Penguin number 6, The Iceberg Lounge. Oswald Cobblepot brings Mr. Falcone a gin martini. Mr. Falcone asks Oswald if he is new. Oswald replies that he has been working here for a few years now. He was part of the cleaning crew, but he was recently promoted. Mr. Falcone throws his drink in Oswald's face and tells him to get the smile off his face. In the bathroom, Oswald cleans the glass and blood from his face. He keeps repeating, never again. Oswald retreats to the roof of an apartment building. An old woman is up there tending to her birds. She asks Oswald what happened to his face. Oswald answers that he fell. She replies that he must be clumsy. Maybe he shouldn't be up here because he could fall pretty hard from up there. The woman tells Oswald that she saw Batman last night. He landed here with a big noise that shook the whole building. She called, Batman! Batman! He looked in her eyes. He wasn't a demon or a bat that is half human. He was just a man with a rope that came swinging in wearing a costume. Just a guy in a costume. That's it. Batman stops a bank robbery at Gotham Bank. When he returns to the Batmobile, he finds a note taped to the window. The note reads, Batman, I know who gives the orders. Meet me on the roof of the Spring Tower Apartments, tomorrow, 4 a.m. The next night, Batman meets with Oswald on the roof of the apartment building. Oswald tells Batman that the woman tending to the birds is his mother. She has some problems in the head and needs looked after 24/7. When he is at work, a lady watches her. Batman states he knows the truth about Cobblepot and the woman. Does he really want to start this with a lie? Oswald reveals that she was only a foster parent that was kind to him, so he calls her mother. Oswald is tired of being abused by the people at the lounge and is willing to give them up to Batman. When they are done, Oswald would like Batman to throw a few dollars his way so he and Ma can have a place outside the city. Oswald feeds Batman vague information at first, but then gives up Falcone's drug shipments. After Batman keeps prodding, Oswald starts giving up some of Falcone's men. Their biggest success in those first few months is interrupting a human trafficking shipment, saving 37 women. Batman keeps an eye on Oswald, learning he is a desperate man with a decent heart who wants respect and needs money. Their arrangement provides him with both. Batman begins to coach Oswald on which information matters and which doesn't. Batman starts going after the Falcone family. Oswald tells Batman that Falcone had a plan to smoke him out and send an army after him. Batman decides it's time to take down Falcone, and Oswald helps him. Oswald tells the old lady that Batman is giving him money to buy the lounge. They have an arrangement. Oswald will run it. He lets the criminals come in, and he tells Batman what they say. Oswald tells the old woman that he wants to thank her and give her a hug for helping him. He couldn't have done it without her. He had to give Batman a reason why he was helping him. Something important. Something noble. Oswald doesn't need her anymore. Oswald pushes her off the roof. To be continued.
Drew, I was a little surprised by the timing of this issue because it felt like we had just gotten set up to actually go into Gotham, which maybe is a good time, like a sort of intermission almost, so to speak. So I wasn't expecting a flashback issue. That being said, once we got it, it was really good. I very much enjoyed this sort of stealth retelling of Penguin's origin, or at least part of the origin. I liked it a lot, Drew.
I liked it a lot, too. The thing about it is, it's different from other Penguin origins I've seen before. So I thought that was interesting, because I don't remember an origin where Batman and Oswald team up like this, where he's feeding him information that I can remember. So I found that intriguing, this arrangement. And how he used the old woman to kind of manipulate Batman into giving him money and then giving him the lounge. I thought it was kind of brilliant, actually. And at the end there, we see Oswald push her off the roof. And what's funny is, at the beginning of the issue, she's telling Oswald to be careful not to fall off the roof. So I thought that was kind of a funny twist.
Yeah. We kind of knew something was going to happen at the end, because we know obviously how it goes, right? We know what happens with Penguin, but I thought still a very effective ending. Really good, Drew. I really liked this issue. Like I said, I was not expecting to get a flashback issue, but really, really good. Very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. And probably, you know, think about it, it probably is a good place for it, because it'd probably feel a little different if we got into the Gotham story and then interrupted it with the flashback, instead of, you know, starting it off with this flashback and then going into the Return to Gotham story. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Amazon's Attack Number 4. Queen Nubia is brought to a place that is on fire. Nubia demands to know why she keeps coming back to this place and what it is. Nubia spots Io and chases after her. Amazon Safe House, Brazil. Yara Flor is searching for the Esquisita. Instead, she finds an empty house except for Anaya, who is sleeping on the couch. Asylum is written on the walls in blood in the next room. Cassie shows up, stating that every single safe house has gone dark. Yara Flor goes back into the front room to find Anaya gone. Suddenly, there's an explosion. Axe troops enter the house, telling the Wonder Girls to come out with their hands up. Cassie decides to make her own secret exit by flying through one of the walls. The Wonder Girls escape. Belle Reve. Mary Bromfield is being hunted by Count Vertigo and other inmates who have been upgraded with Dr. Savannah's phone tech magic. Mary ducks into a room and transforms into Mary Marvel. Count Vertigo's powers have been upgraded by Dr. Savannah. He can now enter people's minds and realizes that Mary Marvel is Mary Bromfield. Right when Count Vertigo is about to kill Mary, Cassie and Yara Flor create a secret entrance. Together, the three women are able to defeat Count Vertigo and his cronies. Nubia is chasing after Io. Io runs up to Hippolyta, stating the boats are gone. Philippus got everyone out she could, but Io is not leaving Hippolyta. Hercules' army is hunting her. Io is shot in the head with an arrow. Hippolyta accuses Nubia of destroying everything. She accuses Nubia of opening the gates to Hercules and his army. Themyscira has fallen. Hippolyta walks through Nubia as if she's a ghost and points at a mysterious black cloak figure behind her. The Garden of Hesperides, Orchard of the Golden Apples. Ares, the goddess of chaos, is dead. She was killed with the spear of Ishtar that Faruka recognizes from the armory of the Bana Migal. Faruka realizes there is a traitor among them. Suddenly, Faruka is surrounded by Peacemaker and Axe soldiers. Peacemaker commands Faruka to surrender or he'll shoot Queen Nubia in the head in the name of peace. An unknown traitor is in their midst, a fallen city in their past, a worldwide militia that's finally caught them. Find out who survives in the next issue of Amazon's Attack.
Drew, I didn't remember in the last issue where the two Wonder Girls and Mary Marvel went. I was a little confused by them being at Belrive because I distinctly remembered the other part of the other two finding Eris dead on the tree. And so I'll admit, I just don't remember, you know, what the other three had been up to. I guess probably because of the most recent Wonder Woman issue, they were otherwise disposed being part of that story.
Right. This issue said this happens before that Wonder Woman issue. So.
Right. Yeah. No, I know. I just couldn't remember what they had been up to in this series. They had split up, but I didn't remember what those three had done to split up.
This is what I remember from last issue. When they split up, we had Nubia and Faruka. They were going to investigate Ares. Mary was going to Belrive. If I remember right, Yara Flor was supposed to go with Mary, I thought. No, maybe she was supposed to go with Cassie. She was supposed to go with one of them, and she went off looking for the Esquisita because she was more concerned about finding them. If I remember right, Cassie went to Greece, to that camp for the Amazons, safe place for the Amazons, and she talked to that archaeologist. And then Mary went to Belrive, so Mary was already at Belrive. So Cassie went to Greece, and then after she was finished there, she came back to Brazil, because we see her in Brazil at the beginning of this issue, meeting up with Yara Flor. So that's what happened. Took me a minute to remember that.
Gotcha. That's helpful. One thing, Drew, I did find... I enjoyed this issue, and I have enjoyed the series. It is heavily reliant, I think, on reading Wonder Woman. I'm not sure how well it would read on its own. But that being said, I have enjoyed the series so far. One thing that did annoy me, though, Drew, was... Count Vertigo chasing Mary, and then she runs off into a cell, and then all of a sudden Mary Marvel pops up, and it doesn't even occur to him for one second that maybe they're the same person. What?
I know. and they have to point out the fact that he can now read minds or something to figure it out.
He doesn't figure it out. I don't think he ever figures it out, Drew.
Yeah, he does, because he specifically says if he kills Mary Marvel, he's going to kill Mary Bromfield because he figured out they're tied together or something.
I thought he just said if he kills her, then that's the only thing stopping him from killing the girl that he's chasing after. It was not clear to me that he ever fully understood that it was the same person. And I really couldn't get past that. It's like, come on, guys. Like, if Bruce Wayne runs into a closet and then Batman pops out, no one's going to be like, oh, maybe they're the same person. Especially Mary Marvel, who is generally shown to look roughly the same in appearance. It's not like Billy, who goes from kid to adult.
Right, Mary just goes from...
Mary basically just puts on a costume. I'm aware that that's not literally what happens, but it's basically it.
Yes.
Anyway, that was silly. But other than that, you know, I'm intrigued at what's going on. You know, both for the mystery of this book and how it's going to correlate to the overall Wonder Woman story. I also, Drew, one thing I'll mention later is I felt like we were getting a little, potentially some reference to this Wonder Woman story in the Titans Beast World as well. So I'm curious how much that this Wonder Woman story is going to kind of bleed out as time goes on. I think, obviously, it certainly will, right? It feels like Trinity is here to stay as a character. I know that we haven't seen a ton of her directly other than in backups, but DC seems pretty invested in her being a character. So I'm kind of excited, obviously, for more of this Wonder Woman story because I'm really enjoying it. But I'm also kind of curious to see the sort of short-term legacy, in a sense, of where this goes, because I do feel like it's a, you know, this is a long-term character that we're seeing and story that we're starting to see the origins of.
Now, DC's putting out a Trinity book that collects all those backup stories. It actually comes out with next week's group of comics we'll be reviewing. They said there was supposed to be an original story in it. I've already checked it out. There's not. But they did collect it into one book. So I agree with you. There feels like they're making Trinity to stay. All right. Well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Detective Comics 1081. This is how Batman remembers it in his fevered mind. Talia al Ghul paddles Batman in a boat up the river of life and death. She wept for him because inside of him were two demons, one at his back, clawing to get his soul, the other keeping him alive, fascinated by a desperate man holding on to his last shred of hope. Talia takes him to a desert known as Arez. For 12 days and 12 nights, she bore him on the back of a steed. When she dropped him off, she told him to cross the desert as the gods have willed. She will wait for him on the other side. She then departs. Bruce wakes up to find Simon Hurt sitting in a chair. Simon tells Bruce that he has died. Perhaps not all the way, but close enough. Bruce states that this can't be real. He needs to get back to Gotham. Simon explains that Talia gave him some tea that makes things as real as you want them to be. It's time to answer the question you have been avoiding. Who are you really? All day, Batman battles a wolf. At night, Batman must crawl toward whatever end he must reach. When he at last has crossed the desert, only one will survive, and then he will be free. Renee Montoya blames herself for the death of Henry Fielding. He wanted off his detail, but she kept him on it. The blood is on her hands. She puts on the mask to ask why Henry Fielding had to die. Detective Alan Nash's mother lives in an apartment with her son. He usually brings home the groceries, but he hasn't been home in days. The question rifles through his things, looking for answers. She finds receipts for a storage unit by the docks. She knows this is her next destination. The question finds Alan Nash at his storage unit, a bullet in his head by his own hand. A note reads, "I, Alan Nash, killed my partner, Henry Fielding." ... When the Batman has beaten the wolf, he comes across a tree of despair. A man there named Farid Parise tells him, "There is one simple truth of this place. There is only one way out of the desert. The only way to no longer be lost. Find yourself." Bruce replies, "I know who I am. I'm Batman." Farid tells Batman that mere words will not be enough. The Batman is dead, but Miss may never die as long as there is a reason to persist and as long as there are those who refuse to forget. The compass is not broken, merely without direction. Batman wanders through the desert with new hope coming upon his first temptation. Simon Hurt welcomes his boy to the Gotham that Batman saved. To be continued. We also had a backup story. His name was Dr. Hurt Part 1. A woman tells a therapy group that she met Simon in a bar. He introduced her to his friends, opens doors for her, and would call her rather than text. She knew she found Mr. Wright. They were married a year later and moved to a house upstate. He wanted children, but it didn't seem to be in the cards for them. Three times it went wrong. After the third time, he tutted like he was disappointed and walked straight out the door and never came back. She calls Simon's best friend, the best man at their wedding, and discovers he was only an actor who was well paid. All Simon's other friends had the same story. The woman had to move out of the house. Simon hadn't been making any mortgage payments from his end. Then she found out he never filed their marriage paperwork, so their marriage was a sham. Another man shares his story, stating he wanted to be a superhero. His master told him that he had trained Batman so he could train him as well. It would be the hardest thing he ever did. He learned gymnastics, martial arts, meditation, chemistry, biology. It took 2 years. He was never going to be Batman, but he was going to be good. The Master even helped him with his costume. The Master stood with him on a rooftop, smiling as he handed him his grapple line. They had made for him so that he could move across the city the same way Batman does. The new hero leaps off the building, shooting his grapple. There is no rope on it. The man falls. The man is still recovering, which is in itself a miracle. The Master never dared show his face again. The leader of the therapy group states he was victimized also. He was kidnapped and tortured with rites of exorcism over and over again. He knew he wasn't possessed, but he was trying to evict him from his own body, and it worked. When he got bored of him, he released him. He didn't know who he was before, but he knew the name of his captor, Dr. Hurt, the man who victimized them all. The leader of the group knows where Dr. Hurt is going to be tomorrow night. The question he poses is if the four of them have what it takes to kill Dr. Hurt. To be continued.
Drew, I really, really enjoyed the backup. It was so good. It was the way they built up Dr. Hurt as just this just completely, you know, prime evil, right? Like the devil. Again, a lot in more. I've mentioned that Dr. Hurt was a major player in Morrison's run on Batman, and he was nominally connected to Bruce in different ways, but there was always this like strong suggestion that he was the devil, right? Or something like the devil. And I love how they played up on the idea of that here, where like the commitment to evil, really, right, was just so above and beyond what any normal person would do. Like the first lady who gets married to him, has a house, attempts to have a kid with him multiple times, all for what, Drew? For apparently nothing. This guy spends months, if not years, training this guy to be another superhero, gets him to a point where he is legitimately ready to go, and then effectively tosses him off a roof. Why? Right? All of it is just cruelty for cruelty's sake. Evil for being evil, but like next level. Oh man, Drew, I really enjoyed the backup. I am very, very excited for the next installment of that.
I really enjoyed the backup too. And honestly, they could have made that its own issue. If you ask me, they could have strung that out a little bit. We and had more in depth with the different stories of the characters around this table. I mean, we got the full story of First Lady and the second guy, but I think they could have gone into more detail with some of the other characters for a full issue. It was really good. I agree with you. It was evil to the next level. I really enjoyed that story too. And I'm looking forward to see how it goes back into the main story. Ron B is very good putting his backups back into the story, so... And that backup's one of the best ones we've read, I think.
Yeah. And what was interesting to note was that it was not Ron B. that wrote the backup either.
Oh, it wasn't? Oh, I thought it was.
I know. It surprised me too, Drew. Going into the main issue, we see Dr. Hurt is starting to be more relevant to the story in this one. We see him directly interacting with Bruce.
But my question is he really there or is Bruce hallucinating it?
I think... In a sense, he is there, Drew, because the strong implication that they're running with is that he's the devil, right? And in a sense, he would be there because what's he vying for? And again, they're not outright coming out and saying it, but he wants his soul, basically, right? He wants Bruce to be the version of Batman that he wants to see. And it's essentially the devil, you know, coming for his soul. It was a very biblical feel, I felt, to Bruce's journey through the desert. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, the person that he encounters is the guy from the myth that we've been seeing pop up in Ron B's run, right?
I'm pretty sure that's who that was.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. So
and then that, it kind of tied in. It was interesting how it ties into that crossing the desert story we've been seeing with Damian and his mother.
And we had seen that myth mentioned before, too. This is one thing I really enjoy with Ron V, is that sometimes he'll put something in that maybe feels a little bit out of left field. Like, it's good and it's engaging, but you're like, what does this totally have to do with the story? And he always comes back to stuff that he puts in. He's very good at kind of keeping track of these threads and then pulling them right back into the story when you maybe don't expect it. It's something something we saw in some of the other books that we read by him, and it's something I continue to really enjoy in this Detective Comics run that he's done. This was just a really great issue overall. I mean, I preferred the backup only because I'm just unbelievably intrigued in the story that they're doing, But the main issue was good as well. It was a little harder to follow because we kind of went back and forth between a very like clear what is actually going on with the question in terms of what we're seeing is what's happening, and unclear what, you know, what is the level of sort of dream state that we're seeing Bruce in. So it was a little, you know, it was a little bit hard to kind of bounce back and forth between those, but still really enjoyable. It's just a really good Batman book because I think it gives you a little bit of everything with what you want from Batman. You have, you know, kind of classic, I'm Batman. Like, we literally have him like, who are you? I know who I am. I'm Batman. But it's not just that, right? It's not just the Batman going over the top, you know, being, you know, James Bond, Batman, whatever. We get the detective. It feels like a detective story sometimes. We get a little bit of the supernatural, which Batman always, I feel like, blends into well for as relatively grounded of a character as he is. It's just good stuff. And the artwork, I thought, was good for both in that, you know, getting the more straightforward question is more kind of straightforward comic book art in a sense. And then the Bruce Wayne stuff that's a little bit more dreamy, a little more surreal, and the artwork reflected that. I thought that was really good.
Totally agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. The Flash number 5. Jay West is sitting outside the principal's office when his left arm starts glowing red. He's trying to get the anger out. A blob of red shoots out of his arm like clay and forms a small humanoid shape. A man calls his name. Startled, Jay uncontrollably teleports to where his father is. The scientists at Terrific Tech are investigating the phenomenon that is tied to the Flash. Michael Holt asks Wally to prep the instruments. Michael believes that whatever it is, it's squeezing realities together. Not multiversal alternates, but cosmological dimensions with overlapping frequencies, each with its own laws of physics. Michael believes it's dangerous since unique realities don't mix. A brain in a box with eyes asks Jay what he is looking at. Startled, Jay teleports back to the bench outside of the principal's office. The strange man who startled Jay in the first place is there, holding the tiny blob humanoid Jay created earlier. Jay believes the man is a supervillain. The man taps Jay on the forehead and tells him to chill. Suddenly, many more clay blob humanoids appear and go running all over the place. The scientist guy zaps one of the blobs, and Jay teleports again. Jay watches from a monitor as the Flash Wally West consults with Gorilla Grodd. The Flash knows the Grodd clone Ultra Humanite's brain to perform calculations which change reality. Grodd catches the smell of Jay West and breaks out of his restraints. Grodd states that Mingyu prophesied that Grodd would break his enemy's heart before devouring it. The slaughter of his son would also work. Jay speaks through the microphone and asks Grodd, "Why do you do what you do?" Grodd answers, "Nothing I do. None of it is too great a price to build a world of choices for his children, which would be the priority of any responsible father." Jay is suddenly teleported back to the bench outside of the principal's office. The scientist is there holding one of the blobs. He introduces himself to Jay as Inspector Pilgrim, science detective. The inspector tells Jay he is different. Instead of tapping into the speed force, he reshapes it. Jay's abilities allow him to teleport to any Speed Force user anywhere, maybe any when. Jay tries teleporting again. First he goes to Iree, who is looking at banned books in the school library during a bathroom break. Next, Jay travels to Barry Allen and Iris, where they are discussing Barry's headaches. After that, Jay transports to his brother Wade, who is crying in his crib as his mother Linda tries to console him. Finally, Jay teleports back to the Flash Wally West, who is arguing with Impulse. Impulse is upset that Max is still missing. Impulse tells Wally that he is going to Time Point, the Speedster's sanctuary, to get help from the Gold Beetle. Wally tells Impulse not to do anything rash, but Impulse is gone before Wally can finish his sentence. After Impulse leaves, Wally calls out Jay, stating he knows he's been sneaking around all day. Jay is about to tell his dad something important when suddenly the stillness appears, interrupting Michael Holt's experiment. The Flash charges the still, and the purple one zaps him. The stillness realized that Jay is a shaper, and all three stillness beings zap him, creating multiple blob beings. Wally loses his temper and zaps the stillness with Speed Force lightning. Then everything disappears. The stillness, the phenomenon, it's all over. Jay tells his father that he doesn't want to be a superhero. Wally hugs his son and tells him, "Whatever makes you happy." Then the Flash disappears. Jay tries to follow him to the place with statues everywhere, but Jay loses him. To be continued.
All I know, Drew, is that Grant Morrison is writing under a pseudonym, and I will not accept a different answer.
There was a lot that happened in this issue, a lot, and it was kind of hard to keep track of everything that was going on.
Yeah, it's tough because the comic is doing a very good job of showing how Wally is being pulled in different directions, right? There's something going on with Barry that nobody's talking about, that we've got Max Mercury stuck somewhere in a different dimension. We've got his own kids that he's trying to deal with. He's got his job that he's trying to deal with, these interdimensional beings that are, like, there. And you see him, he's getting, like, the comic's name, Top Priority, and he keeps telling all these people that they're his top priority. You know, of course, we see that he genuinely means it when it comes to his kids, of course. So, like, I think the comic is doing a good job in that regard, Drew, but it feels almost stressful to read because so many different things are happening. I have a general gist of what is going on for most of them. I won't fully understand any of it because I don't. But, like, I kind of follow the general, you know, idea of what we're doing, but it feels very chaotic. Which I know is the point, but it doesn't make it any easier to read.
Doesn't it make it any easier to write notes for either? But one thing I wanted to point out is we had an issue recently that focused on Iree. This one focused on Jay. So I found that interesting, that we focused on Iree and we focused on Jay. I kind of like that. And we're learning more about Jay's powers, because I don't really know much about Jay's powers. And I found it interesting that he can teleport to different speedsters, which I think is a setup for finding Max. We'll see if that happens down the line here. But also, what all these blob things and stuff, his abilities are interesting, to say the least. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week. Titans Beast World number 5. Garro is dead. Raven tells Donna Troy that someone with the Helm of Chaos was out here and might be behind it all. 2 hours later, the president addresses the American people, stating that earlier this morning, the Bureau of Sovereignty conducted an operation against the Star Conqueror, formerly known as Beast Boy. The operation was a success, and the Conqueror has been defeated. The president introduces Amanda Waller to the nation. Amanda Waller tells the public that Chester Runk is the real hero that saved them from Beast Boy, not the Titans. Having lost his own son to Beast Boy's attack, Chester Runk volunteered to take down Garfield Logan in a way only he could. Chester was their savior, a man willing to work with the government. The threat is not over. There will be no new spores, but the infected are still out there killing indiscriminately. In 2 hours, the monsters left will be targeted globally by drones, an estimated 1 million monsters. It's not an easy decision, but the right one. The world thanks you for your sacrifice. Hours later, at the secret headquarters of the Bureau of Sovereignty, the Flash Wally West relocates the guards and confiscates their communication. Nightwing tells Amanda Waller he is here to talk. Peacemaker tries to shoot Nightwing with Amanda's approval, but Nightwing takes him down. Nightwing tells Amanda Waller to call off the strikes, but she refuses. Cyborg takes control of the drones and calls off the attack. Nightwing tells Waller that the Titans will not allow her to become a dictator. Amanda replies that if she knew how reckless and stupid the Titans would act, she would have killed Garfield Logan years ago. Raven loses it, blasting Waller into a wall. Raven tells Waller she would kill her, but Gar wouldn't want that. His compassion is the only thing holding her back. Suddenly, Dr. Hate shows up, telling Raven to look at the gem she holds in her hand. It is empty. The demon that was trapped within has already been released. Dr. Hate removes the Helmet of Chaos to reveal the evil version of Raven. To be concluded.
My biggest complaint, Drew, is what we've been saying for a few weeks now, which is, what is this story even about? Who's the main character here? What is the main takeaway that we're supposed to get from this? Is it Waller, you know, moving the chess pieces on the board? Is it Dr. Hate? Is it Beast Boy? I mean, the event is nominally named after him. Is it Nightwing? Like, it feels constantly like the focus of the book changes every issue. It's like, just kidding, this is actually what the story is about. Just kidding, this is what the story is actually about. And, like, at a certain point, I would really like Taylor to commit to one of them.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you on that. The focus just keeps changing and changing and changing. And it looks like it's going to be concluded next issue. And it looks like we're going to be focusing on the evil version of Raven. I'm trying to remember if I knew there was a demon that was trapped in that gem on her head, or that's something that was new, or I can't remember.
I mean, I thought traditionally it was her dad, but clearly that's not the case with this version. I'm not up to date on, I mean, I'm sure it's tied to a more recent version of Teen Titans, but I will admit I'm just not, I guess, familiar enough to know. I mean, I don't know how satisfied I was with that reveal. I think we knew that Dr. Hate was going to have to be somebody that we knew, and I don't know that there was a better alternative than Evil Raven, but I mean, still, I don't know that I was wholly satisfied with that. And if we're going to have Evil Raven, like, Dr. Hate, I mean, really, though? I just can't get over that.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. The reveal, I don't know, I was just kind of okay. Yeah. You know what I mean? They revealed it, and I'm like, okay.
I do like that it was some, like I said, I think it had to be somebody we knew. I don't think they could get away with a, like, Leviathan. Remember when Leviathan was technically a comic book character, but it was one that, like, only extremely, extremely knowledgeable DC fans would be like, oh, yeah, that guy. It's like, that's not really satisfying. I like that it was somebody recognizable. I think it needed to be that, and I think it was more effective, relatively speaking, than it would have been. Like, Drew, if that was a nobody under there or like a new character, I mean, I don't know what that scene would have done, but I'm not that jazzed at the reveal either. One thing I do want to talk about, though, real quick, Drew, and it was the thoughts that I don't remember if we talked about it last time, but I've had for the last couple issues, is the Bureau of Sovereignty, and using that word specifically makes me wonder, this feels like it's got at least a little bit of connection to Wonder Woman, right? Because we know that at least right now with Wonder Woman, America has been secretly ruled by a sovereign, and that, yes, the Bureau wouldn't answer to the president because it would answer to the king. That I mean, I know that Waller is supposed to be sort of spearheading this herself, you know, trying to apparently rule herself, which again doesn't feel right and would make more sense if, you know, in some way she was serving the sovereign, which that agency's name, and we saw, you know, Sergeant Steele was leading that bureau as well. It feels like there's a connection there, Drew. I don't know if that's right or not. I don't know if it's just a coincidence that they picked that word because they're trying to, you know, institute Waller kind of ruling herself. I don't know, but it feels like there should be some sort of connection there.
I agree with you. That's the exact same thing I was wondering when I saw that word sovereignty too. And it does feel like Amanda Waller is kind of trying to lead stuff, but it would be interesting to find out if she did answer to the Sovereign from the Wonder Woman comics. At least it would be tied together that way. But
it would just make more sense because, in this book, we get her and Nightwing talking, and it makes it fairly clear that she wants to essentially control the world, which I know that Waller wants nothing more than control. I get that, Drew, but it's never... I'm not on board with the version of Waller that wants to be queen. Like, that just doesn't jive with me with what she usually is. She very much likes to rule from the shadows, and having her come out and be publicly facing and yet still be very openly Waller, just none of that felt right to me, Drew.
It'll be interesting to find out if she is connected to the Sovereign or not. Maybe that would make things make a little more sense. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll review Bodies.
Pardon the interruption. We'll bring you back to your podcast in just a moment. But first, promo for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
In the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, your pizza delivery guys, Dan, Sean, and Paul, serve you a slice of life.
As we discuss literally anything in the universe.
Conspiracy theories?
Movies that we've liked. Women in comedy, voice actors, film directors and producers, authors. But what we don't talk about is pizzas.
Wednesday, I'm here with you people. It's wild.
Tune in to the Dragon Con Report podcast, your ultimate destination for all things Dragon Con.
Join us each month as we dive into our home away from home and cover the world of con fandom, cosplay, gaming, and more.
With guests each show, behind the scenes insights, tips and tricks, and the latest updates on this year's convention.
Whether you're a seasoned attendee or a first-time explorer,
the DragonCon Report is your passport to the ultimate geek experience.
Join us and let your inner dragon roar.
And we're back. Let's talk Bodies, Season 1, Episode 1, You're Dead Already. 2023. Detective Sahara Hassan spots a suspicious man hiding behind a dumpster during a protest march. Suddenly, the streetlights flicker, a bulb shatters, and her walkie-talkie stops working. The man behind the dumpster pulls out a handgun. Detective Hassan chases after him. When she finally catches up to him, he is standing next to a naked body, lying on the pavement. The man tells her to put her taser down. She complies, and then he runs off. The detective examines the body and then calls it in. She notices a marking on his wrist, and the left eye is missing. She is on Long Harvest Lane. 1941. Sergeant Charles Whiteman receives a call from a woman telling him that he has an errand. A black Wolseley will be left for him, with the keys above the front wheel. He will drive it to Long Harvest Lane to pick up a body by 10:15 p.m., no later. Then he is to drive the body to Royal Albert Dock and leave it there. Sergeant Whiteman tells the woman that he is being watched. She replies that is why they pay him so well. Suddenly, the lights in the police department start blinking on and off. One of the bulbs shatter. The rest of the lights come back on. Later that night, the sergeant arrives at Long Harvest Lane to pick up the body. He finds it naked with a marking on his wrist and the left eye missing. 1890. Inspector Alfred Hillinghead watches as a boy is being arrested for stealing when the street lights begin to flicker and another bulb shatters. Officer Webb brings Inspector Hillinghead to Long Harvest Lane where there is a dead body. Journalist Henry Ash has taken a picture of the body. It has a marking on the wrist and the left eye is missing. 2023. Detective Hassan learns that the suspect's name is Saeed Tahir. He was identified from CCTV before the blackout. 1890. An autopsy is performed. There is not a bullet in the brain and there is no exit. 1941. Sergeant Whiteman loads up the body as a siren sounds for an air raid. A police car turns on its siren and chases after Sergeant Whiteman. Sergeant Whiteman pulls over. Inspector Goodman comes to the door. When the inspector goes to investigate the trunk, a bomb hits the building near him, shooting out debris. Sergeant Whiteman is still alive, but Inspector Goodman is killed. 2023. Detective Hassan is pulled away from her father's birthday party to learn that there was an MRI done on the John Doe. No bullet was found. Detective Hassan is asked to talk to Saeed's sister, Aaliyah. Detective Hassan talks to Aaliyah and learns that Saeed called his sister to tell her he didn't kill anyone. He knew he was going to come across a dead body before it happened. 1890. Inspector Hillinghead stops by Henry Ash's place to retrieve the photographs before they end up in the newspaper. The inspector spots the reflection of a man's face in one of the pictures. He must have been hiding when Ash spotted the body. When Inspector Hillinghead asks for an alibi, Henry Ash provides him a picture of him with another man. Inspector Hillinghead arrests Ash for the matter of gross indecency and unnatural acts behind closed doors. 1941. Sergeant Whiteman returns to the car where Inspector Goodman was killed by the air raid. Police are already on the scene. Sergeant Whiteman is put in charge of the investigation. Sergeant Whiteman reveals the body in the trunk that he put there. Back at the police station, Sergeant Whiteman receives a phone call from the mysterious woman. She wanted the body, not a police investigation. He failed. She asked Whiteman to destroy all police records immediately by whatever means necessary. He will honor their arrangement or suffer the consequences. 2023. Detective Hassan receives a call from Saeed to meet at the mall. She meets with him, but he refuses to give her the gun. An announcement comes over the loudspeakers that all customers and staff must evacuate the mall immediately. Saeed stands up, pulls a gun out, and fires it into the air. He then points the gun at Detective Hassan. The police swarm their position. When Saeed is distracted, Detective Hassan goes for the gun. Saeed ends up pinning her down and then shoots himself in the mouth. 1890. Ash tells Inspector Hillinghead that the assistant commissioner of police Lieutenant Colonel Richard Pearson's son was the man photographed with him last night at the Molly House. He was his alibi. The man who conducted the autopsy, Ladbroke, recognizes the suspect in the picture. He tells Hillinghead to burn it if he values the life that he has. 2023. Detective Hassan realizes there was a kid at Saeed's table before she got there. The security footage confirms it. Detective Hassan realizes that that kid has been watching her. The year 2053. Detective Maplewood is driving her car down the street when a street light shatters and her electric car is disabled. She steps out of the car as it reboots. The AI confirms that an anomaly had been detected on Long Harvest Lane. Detective Maplewood checks it out and finds a deceased naked male with a gunshot wound to the head. Suddenly, the man starts breathing. I hope that wasn't too confusing for our listeners.
No, I don't know. I hope our listeners at least go and check the first episode out of this, Drew, because it was a hell of a first episode. It hooked me pretty much immediately. And when we tend to watch new stuff, sometimes my wife will watch, sometimes we won't. She won't, or she'll start, and if it, you know, catches her interest, she'll keep watching. This had her hooked immediately, Drew. Like within 10 minutes, it was very clear that this was going to be both of us watching this entire series. I really, really enjoyed this first episode. And I went into this completely blind. I didn't watch any, you know, trailer before we started watching. I didn't read any synopsis. I've not read the comic. I didn't even know the comic existed, so shame on me for that. I had no idea. I literally had no idea what the show was going to be about when I hit play, Drew. And that made it all the more fascinating when we started getting time jumps. I was like, oh, I love this. It made it a great surprise, especially when we got the... I told my wife, I was like, I'm waiting for a fourth timeline. It feels like there should be one more. I thought it was going to go further back in time because we had that shot of the medieval knight in the modern day scene. And I thought maybe we'd, you know, jump back further. But instead, the show surprised me by jumping forward. Man, really cool, Drew. I really enjoyed this episode.
I really enjoyed it, too. The only thing I knew about this show going into it, there was supposed to be a dead body showing up in the different time periods. Because we announced this on DC News at one point. And I knew it was from a DC Vertigo comic. And that's the only thing I knew about it. So I went into this basically not knowing anything either, and I was hooked right away too. And let me tell you, it was fascinating. I knew what was going on, but trying to recap everybody's name, because it's easier to recognize faces when you're watching the show,
yeah,
instead of knowing everybody's name. To do the recap, I had to figure out everybody's name. I got IMDb up, and I'm like watching the show, going back, okay, who's this character? Who's this character? You know, trying to differentiate one. And I actually got one of the characters' names wrong. I had to go back and fix it through my notes because I got confused on what the character's name was. But I think I got everything sorted out. But when I recapped this, I'm like, I hope the listeners follow along. If they watched it, it's probably a lot easier to follow along than not watching it.
Yeah, for sure.
But oh man, it is so interesting. I'm excited to check out the next episode. That's for sure. Very intrigued with the mystery. And I'm with you. I was waiting for that fourth time period because I knew there was four different time periods. I also thought it was going to jump back further too, and was surprised it went to the future. And it, not only that, I was surprised the dude woke up. So
yeah, that shocked me. One thing I really liked that the episode did, Drew, and I would be interested to read the comic to see if, you know, the comic played around with this too, was the idea of putting panels in and having simultaneous action going on sometimes. So it almost felt like you had a spread page where you saw essentially the same scene. You could see it, how it would look if it was a comic book. And I thought that was so clever for, you know, a comic book adaptation. Now, I know it's certainly not the first, you know, live-action thing to do that. Ang Lee's Hulk, for example, did comic book panels as well. Arguably not as great of a product, but... So I know other people have done it, but I thought the show did it really well. And it was such a nice way to make it feel like it was a comic book adaptation, because I know a lot of people, when they hear comic book, they think superhero. And obviously, you know, we've reviewed things that disprove that, and most of our listeners would know that, but I like how this would be very easy that for them to just do this series and to not really lean into or address the fact that it's a comic book, right? And just sort of make it its own story. And I like that it didn't try to hide what it came from, and in fact kind of leaned into it and was like, no, this is a graphic novel, and let me, we're almost adapting the feel of the graphic novel to the screen. I really liked that.
I noticed that they flashed the comic creator's name on the screen at one point, I think in the credits or something. He's passed away. So he passed away in 2021. So he may not even got to see this project on the screen.
That's a bummer, because they've done, at least through one episode, Drew, they've done a great job. I mean, obviously, we don't know for sure how it will play out ultimately. But man, I mean, an incredibly strong first episode. I really enjoyed this. Like I said, I went in so blind. I was honestly partly just kind of crossing my fingers because I didn't know what the critical reaction to this was either. I was like, man, I hope this is good. And it was so quickly too. Man, very, very excited for the rest of this show.
I am too. All right. Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah. So obviously I have to shout out the original graphic novel, also called Bodies, by Cy Spencer. I will admit, again, some ignorance on this. I have not read the comic. There are four artists listed: Phil Winslade, Tula Lote, Megan Hetrick, and Dean Ormston, which to me, Drew, feels like if you've got four artists and four timelines, that the art would be different depending on the timeline. I cannot say for sure that that is the case because I haven't read it, but that's certainly the feeling that I get looking at the credits. It is also a miniseries. It wasn't like a big long go. It was an 8-issue miniseries. We're getting an 8-episode miniseries. It really makes me wonder how closely adapted the show is going to be to the book, Drew. Because, again, coming from a complete place of ignorance, it sure feels like it's not trying to disassociate itself from the comic. And that's super cool.
Yeah. If I remember what I read right about the show, it was from, I think the comic came out in like 2014 or something. So not too long ago.
Yeah.
I guess it would be about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, so pretty recent, relatively speaking, especially for, you know, how things tend to get adapted, you know, and get turned into projects. So, again, I you know, if our readers or listeners have already seen the show, I highly recommend checking out the original source. I am certainly, it's something I'm going to check out on my own as well, because I was so hooked by the first episode. I really want to see what graphic novel version of this story looks like as well, because I think I'll really enjoy it.
It must have been good enough for them to want to adopt it to the television, so.
Clearly.
Yeah. All right, and for my shout out, I was watching Lost Season 1 Episode 14 called Special. And a kid on there, Walt, was reading a comic book, and it was a Spanish version of a Flash comic. And then I looked, so I had to Google it to see what their comic book it actually was. It was Green Lantern Flash Faster Friends number 1 from 1997. Kyle Rayner and Wally West must team up to rescue their Golden Age counterparts, Alan Scott and Jay Garrick, from aliens who have abducted them. I didn't remember this comic, but when I saw him flipping the comic, I recognized Kyle's costume. And I figured, you know, the time period, that had to be the Wally West Flash. So I was like, cool. And I had to check out to see what comic it was. But when the kid was reading it, it was the Spanish version. So, which, of course, he told his dad. He's like, his dad's like, how can you read that? It's in Spanish. He's like, I like the art. So that's my shout out for this week. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message, text us, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman Off-World, Batman Superman World's Finest 2024 Annual. We got Alan Scott, The Green Lantern, Titans Beast World number 6, and our second episode of Bodies. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman. All the world is waiting for you, and the power you possess
fighting for your rights, and the old red, white, and blue.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.